This is the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 710 Cairo.
I am Paul Harris, proud to be filling in for the Crusader for Common Sense, who's off on vacation after celebrating his 30th anniversary on Cairo last week. And by the way, when he comes back next week, it'll be both Cairo AM and FM. Starts a week from tomorrow. Anybody hear this? On both 710 AM and 97.3 FM starting on August 12th. More details, go to mynorthwest.com. Click on the Cairo section and get all the details on the simulcast, which begins 1 week from tomorrow here on Cairo. Let me introduce you to Joel McCower, who is one of the most sought-after green business strategists in the country. Some people have even called him the guru of green business practices. He is online at a website called readjoel.com and greenbiz.com. And I've invited him to talk a little bit about some of this green economy that we keep hearing about. Joel, welcome to News Talk 710 Cairo.
Good morning, Paul.
I've known you a long time, going back to the days when you wrote your first green consumer book. And in the, decade and a half or so since then,
Almost 20 years
since you wrote that book, green has become more and more an important word in the world of business. Where are we now in terms of the hype that has been part of the word green when it comes to business in America?
You know, Paul, the two questions I get asked most frequently by audiences, by reporters, talk show hosts, and others is this a bubble or a fad, number one? And number two, have we reached a tipping point, a point where this stuff is really sort of taking off? And the answer to both is no. It's not a fad. This is a fundamental change in how business is being done. And yes, we've been hearing a lot more about it for the past couple years, maybe since that movie came out from Al Gore. But this is a overnight sensation, except that the night began about, 20 years ago. And this has been going on a long, long time, where companies are integrating environmental thinking into their operation and in a way that aligns with profitability and other sources of business value.
So it's not that they're doing it just because they want to be green, they want to be good citizens of the planet Earth. They're also doing it because it's accruing to their own bottom line.
Now, this is a capitalist plot, Paul. This is really, this is about how companies see this as not just a wave of PR benefits, although there's some of that, of course, but this is a wave of innovation and forward thinking and the way to be a better, more efficient business and attract employees and keep customers and a whole range of other things. And, of course, address some of the challenging energy and environmental problems that we have.
You know, I was talking last hour about oil and the energy crisis, et cetera, and I've long wondered why Detroit was so far behind when it came to things like fuel efficiency. Is that part of the green movement in this country, trying to push the auto industry in that direction, or is more of your focus elsewhere?
Well, no, the car industry is at the heart of all of this. I mean, this is, you know, an industry that really speaks to all things that aren't green now and that can be, and as I was just saying a second ago, to this new wave of innovation and creative thinking and new businesses and new products and even whole new business models and systems of commerce. The U.S. auto industry, you know, they sort of been dragged kicking and screaming into this because they had this, you know, in hindsight, misguided notion that they could coast forever selling big SUVs and trucks, and which were very, very profitable, and that there was no market for smaller fuel efficient or electric or plug-in hybrid or other kinds of so-called alternative fuel vehicles. But now, guess what? That's where Ford and GM and not to mention Toyota and Honda and a bunch of others are betting the farm, that that's where the new markets are going to be, and that their growth, in fact, in the case of GM and Ford, their saving grace is going to be from those cars.
So is this about old companies finally getting a new message or new companies that are innovating and changing things? Which is more prevalent these days and which is more important to the green economy?
Well, the good news is they both are more prevalent and they both are more important. I mean, you know, this is an incredible amount of stuff going on. If you go to greenbiz.com, the site that I edit every day, you know, we have just amazing stories of what companies are doing in terms of, you know, things that aren't necessarily going to show up in the products. You're not going to see them directly, but they have to do with how they manufacture and source these things and run their buildings and run their operations. And there's just, it's sort of jaw-dropping when you look in it, you know, sort of every day and every week, week in, week out for the past few years. Those are just the big companies. And then there's the thousands and thousands of smaller startup companies that are making some kinds of green and clean products. And then there's a third category, Paul, which are, you know, almost every town, every city, certainly in Seattle, all over the place, you've got your green dry cleaner, your green travel agent, your green auto mechanic, your green product store, your green lawn care company, also green restaurants, and all sorts of just traditional small local businesses that are they're now operating through a green lens, partly because they want to attract employees and customers, but also because that's the way they want to run a business.
But I got to tell you, you know me, I'm a skeptic. I see them using that word green, and I think, well, they're not really doing anything, or they may be doing a tiny little bit, but they're using that as a marketing tool.
Well, you know, there's some of that, and absolutely, when there's a trend that, you know, the PR companies and the marketing companies are going to do all they can to exploit it and to push the envelope and find out where the limits are, and so there's plenty of that, and some of what the critics call greenwashing. But you know what? It's also in some ways a good thing in that there's this. It just goes to this recognition that this really is real, and that people want these things, and that people want to work for these companies and buy from these companies and invest in these companies. And so, yeah, we'll be pushing the limits here, and some companies will be you know, doing a little bit of greenwashing. But here's the other part, Paul, that nobody really gets. This is an area, actually, where companies are walking more than they're talking. That is, they're doing more than they're saying.
How so?
Well, particularly big companies, when they, this is what I call McCower's paradox. When you point out what you're doing right, you often illuminate problems that the public didn't know you have. so let me explain. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I learned that Levi Strauss, which at the time was the largest cotton buyer in the world, had started sourcing 2% of their annual cotton purchases were going to be made from organic cotton. Now, they weren't going to be putting out a line of organic jeans. They'd been there, done that. They actually started doing that more recently. But at the time, they were just going to mix it into their annual cotton blend the same way that you'd put in some recycled pulp into a larger batch of virgin pulp. They wanted to help build market. They saw this was a coming thing. And I said, well, that's a great story. I want to write about it. So I called them, and they said, well, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it. And so I persevered, and over time, I got them to talk to me about it. And one of the questions I've asked is, well, why don't you want to talk about it? And they said, well, look at it from our perspective. When we explain why we're doing this, we have to explain that a huge percent, almost 25% of the time, 25% of all pesticides on the planet go into growing cotton, and the impacts on groundwater runoff and worker health and safety and the broods of the trees. We risk our customers saying, so you mean 98% of what you buy is bad for people on the planet?
Ah, yeah.
I thought it was the fabric of our lives. Why not 5%? Why not 10? We're going to be doing campus boycotts, so you commit to 10% organic cotton.
And here's a company that has moved forward, has had a progressive nature to what it is doing for its own bottom line, but if it's not far enough, they risk being criticized and looking like the bad guys instead of the good guys.
Exactly. And the reason for that, Paul, is that we don't have an answer to a very basic question when it comes to business and the environment, which is, how good is good enough? We don't know. We know what good enough is for a green building because there's a standard called LEED, LEED, for that. So you now in Seattle, for example, King County, Washington was one of the first counties in the country to specify that all government buildings had to be LEED certified. This is a number of years ago. We know what a green building is, but we don't know what a green business is, and that's a problem.
All right, tell me a couple more stories. Tell me about a big company. Let's start with one that people in this area are very familiar with, Starbucks.
Well, you know, Starbucks is a good example because Starbucks is, has been, and I think they still are, the largest buyer of fair trade coffee in the world. And fair trade coffee is coffee that's been sourced from growers in usually in developing countries, which is, of course, where all coffee is grown, that has been grown in a certain way that's environmentally sensitive, but also where the workers have been paid fairly and treated fairly.
They have some decent human rights standards when it comes to their employees.
Exactly. And so Starbucks is the largest buyer of that in the world, but it's a very small percentage. I'm guessing 1 or 2% of their annual cotton buy. Is that good enough or not? I mean, do you cheer them on for being a leader and helping to create a market and being the largest buyer, or do you beat them up for saying, well, it's only 1% or 2%?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not good enough. So we see a lot of those kinds of examples, and it's kind of confusing for people out there to sort of understand, is this a green company or not?
All right, so where is that line between you're not doing enough and you're doing what you called greenwashing, which is just using the word green for marketing effect when it's not really doing much for the environment at all?
I don't know that there's a bright green line, Paul, between one and the other. In fact, it's pretty fuzzy, greenish-gray line, and I think to a large extent green is in the eye of the beholder. And so, you know, we see, General Motors, for example, which is now, has a breakthrough technology called the Chevy Volt that they're planning on bringing out in 2010. And I can tell you, because I know people there, that they are kind of betting the company on that everybody from Chairman Rick Wagner on down is focused on that. But this is a problem. And, they're late to the game and they've got huge financial problems and they're still trying to get rid of Hummers and all those other cars. You know, is that good enough? I mean, I think that's interesting. Does that make them a green company? No, there's no green companies out there, none that are pure, perfectly green, but it makes them someone who's on the right track, and I think that's pretty interesting.
When we talk about cars, Toyota, of course, grabbed a nice market share for themselves by going to hybrids, and particularly the Prius brand has been a huge success compared to other car brands that have fallen by the wayside. Mostly because of what's happened with gas prices. Has the same thing happened in the world of other consumer goods, like the world of toothpaste and soap and toilet paper?
Not so much. I mean, those are obviously, less sexy products, and, they don't have the status of a car, and we don't, drive them down the street or parade them in front of our friends. And so it's not as much of a status symbol. And we still haven't seen, too many, a green iPod, which is to say a green product that is the hip, cool thing that everybody wants and has, and having it. Now, first of all, it's a great product that does what it works as advertised and provides some benefit to our lives, but also happens to be truly green, in terms of being less impactful on the environment. We haven't really seen many of those. I mean, the Prius is probably as close as it gets. A status symbol in that regard, that you drive down the street and you're saying, hey, I'm saving gas and I'm a green guy. But we haven't seen a lot of those. And so, if you buy, seventh generation or method, cleaner, glass cleaner or furniture polish, is that going to give you any kind of status? Probably not. But those are good products.
Yeah. You turned me on to this company, Seventh Generation, quite a while ago, and we actually ordered some of their products, and they were fine, and, I felt like, ooh, I'm doing something for the environment, but I got to tell you, the toilet paper, not so much.
Yeah, well, to each his own. some people, everybody has personal taste in addition to environmental things, and of course, that's always going to trump what the green stuff, no matter, very, very few people, present company included, you and I, Paul. We're not going to make any or certainly many sacrifices in the name of the planet. And I think that we speak for pretty much 95% or 90% of consumers. We're not going to pay more or much more. We might do it on a few products. We're not going to suffer many inconveniences. We're not going to suffer degradation of quality or aesthetics or other things. We want what we want, and that's the sad truth, but it's the reality for the marketplace.
Yeah, well, there are just certain parts of the body that when you're buying a product, soft beats green every time.
I'll let you talk more about that.
We'll come back and talk more with Joel McCower. You can read him online at readjoel.com, and he's got a book coming out this fall, which we'll get into here in just a couple of minutes as well. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Dave Ross on News Talk 710 Cairo.
Hey, this is Ron.
And why wouldn't I be Don?
Give us all three this afternoon from 3 to 6.
But right now, it's the Dave Ross Show
on News Talk 710 Cairo.
Paul Harris filling in for Dave and talking with Joel McCower, who writes about green business issues. His blog is at readjoel.com, and he's got a book coming out in October called Strategies for the Green Economy. And recently wrote on his blog about GM and the new plug-in infrastructure, because as Joel mentioned, GM is trying to go the electric route with their Volt car that comes out next year. And plug-in hybrids are kind of becoming the new rage in the car industry, aren't they, Joel?
This is where, starting in the model year 2010, we're going to be seeing cars going. We're going to be seeing Ford and Toyota and Nissan and GM coming out. And I mentioned earlier the Chevy Volt, which is a car. It's kind of interesting. It's not simply a Prius that you plug in. A Prius has two different motors, electric motor and a gas motor, and they sort of shift back and forth at any given moment, second to second, based on what's optimal. In the case of the Volt, it's an electric vehicle, plug-in electric vehicle, but it's got a little tiny gas motor. And that motor doesn't go to the wheels like in the Prius. It actually goes to recharge the battery. So if you were to just go 20, 30 miles, you'd only go on the battery. You'd never use any gasoline. But if you wanted to go farther, then the battery wears down and the gas engine kicks on and recharges the battery. And you can actually go 600 or more miles on a tank. It's going to be pretty interesting. It's over 100 mile per gallon equivalent. So we're going to be seeing that. But as companies come out with these kinds of cars, it's not such a simple thing to create this whole new infrastructure like we now have with gas stations and Phillips and all those kinds of things. It's a pretty complicated thing to create the plug-in hybrid infrastructure.
Yeah, you even wrote on your blog that you could plug one into your garage, but that's on the same circuit as some other things in your house, and the question is whether that's going to throw off the infrastructure of your own home when you plug in your car.
Sure. Well, as I said, in my house, I'm lucky enough to have a garage and lucky enough to have a plug in that, which, of course, not everybody does. But it happens to be on the same circuit as my bedroom, so I plug in a vacuum or something, and TiVo doesn't like that.
And what about people who do park their cars on the street or don't have access to an electrical outlet where they park their cars? What are they going to do?
Problem. You know, I think the question is, will we be seeing over time, and particularly in progressive cities like Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and Denver and others, Minneapolis, where, you were going to be seeing hookups on the street where you can plug in your car. And then, of course, you get into issues where, is it going to be a standard plug if you buy your car in Oregon and drive it to Washington? Will it be able to plug it in, or will they have a different setup there? If you buy it from, Toyota, will it be different from GM? And will it be secure so that if you plug in your car and someone comes along and says, well, I need a plug, but I can't find one, so I'll unplug Paul's car so I can plug in mine. I mean, that's going to be a problem. So there's a lot of things we need to do. And then, of course, that we're going to eventually be at a place where we can sell energy from our car back to the grid, just like you can sell it if you have solar panels. And that way, if you have a million plug-in cars with these batteries storing power and sitting idle 90% of the time, they become this big backup power grid, and they can, feed energy in, and we can make money with our cars sitting at work. While we're working, we can be making money not just on our jobs but from our cars. But that's a whole other infrastructure in terms of billing and the telecommunications and the smart stuff. It's pretty complicated.
There's a lot of infrastructure that has to be thought out. What happens if I need to charge it while I'm at work? What if I'm a person who travels a lot for business and I need to plug it in wherever I'm going? Is the hotel valet going to plug my car in? If I need to take my car just for a quick ride and I find that I get to the supermarket and, I forgot to charge it last night. We've all had the problem with our cell phones batteries going dead, or an iPod battery or whatever it is. The same thing could happen. Oh, I forgot. Now I need to charge the car to get home. Are there going to be public charging stations? Could I go to the gas station like when I was a kid with a bicycle and I needed more air in my tire? Will I be able to have an electrical outlet there that I can plug into? Are these things being addressed now, Joel?
Well, it sounds like the Full Employment Act of 2008 for AAA. I don't know. I mean, these are all things that we got to work on, Paul. It's not simply I got a car, I got a plug, I got a socket, end of story. Anytime you create something as an alternative to something as robust as the automobile gas infrastructure that we've had building for the past century, it's going to take some work. But we've got to start somewhere, and I think it's pretty exciting.
It's very exciting. You can read more of Joel's strategies for a green economy in his new book, which is coming out in October. And in the meantime, on his blog at readjoel.com. Joel McCower, thanks for your time this morning.
It's always a pleasure, Paul.
I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Dave Ross on News Talk 710 Cairo.